In his long-running Miami Herald column and his over 30 books, Dave Barry has skewered just about every aspect of American life, from the Revolutionary War to the latest high-tech gadgets. He's won a Pulitzer Prize, and the New York Times has called him the funniest man in America. I'll Mature When I'm Dead, Dave Barry's Amazing Tales of Adulthood, is his latest volume of essays from Putnam, and it takes on marriage, parenthood, and other subjects grown-ups are supposed to know something about. Although I'm not convinced he does consider himself a grown-up, I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And in the light of your title, I met a woman last year who immediately endeared herself to me by declaring that she isn't very mature. So this isn't just a male thing.
No, but it's rarer, I think, with women. Women are born sort of mature. I have a son and a daughter. My son is 29. My daughter is 10. And since my daughter was 4, I feel I would have been more likely to leave my house with her alone than with my son, because they just have a grown-up thing going on. But it's nice if you met a woman, and I'm happy for you, Leonard, by the way.
That I've met a woman.
I think it's good.
This book is
the inflatable doll thing, man.
It gets really tired,
yeah.
Very old.
Although you had some nice models, I have to say. Oh, we're not supposed to discuss this on the air.
This book consists almost entirely of essays that haven't been published before. Is that because you stopped writing for the Miami Herald?
Yeah, I occasionally write for the Herald, but I stopped writing a weekly column about 5 years ago.
Just got tired of it? Because you'd done it for about 25 years?
Yeah, I did it for a long, long time. And I was doing some other things, writing some of these young adult fiction books with Ridley Pearson and just writing other books. And it just felt like a good time to not have that weekly deadline. And so these essays are just sort of humor essays that I would have probably written 800-word columns about back when I was doing that. But this was an opportunity to sort of expand them and do kind of different formats.
So you weren't a victim of the general decline in the newspaper industry?
I think I was the cause of it, because if you'll notice, I stopped writing my column, and then what happened? The newspaper industry went right down the toilet. Now, is that a coincidence? I don't think so.
Well, you do have an essay titled A Practical Workable Plan for Saving the Newspaper Business, and the subtitle is I Sure Don't Have One.
Yeah. I think what we have in the newspaper industry is a demonstration of the extreme foolhardiness of allowing a major industry to be run by English majors. Because when I started out, that's most of the people in the business, the editors, everybody's an English major. And what we didn't realize it was that we had the most perfect situation. Most newspapers were the economic thing when you're the only one that can do monopolies. Mm-hmm. They were monopolies, and they were making tons of money no matter what they put in the newspaper. Anything in the newspaper would, because really people, they didn't, you know, they were selling ads because there was nowhere else to advertise.
Advertisers wanted to be in the newspapers because that's where people saw the ads.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you for telling me what I was trying to spurt out here.
Anyway, I used to do that.
We English majors thought it was because everybody wanted to read what we had to say. And then lo and behold, it turns out that was not the case. So that's not what we're dealing with.
And now people aren't running ads in them anymore. No. Do you think that there is a way newspapers can successfully integrate into the digital age and still turn a profit?
Well, here's our current business model. We're going to take all this content that we used to charge people money for, and we're going to put it on the internet and give it away for free. And then we're going to wait and see what happens. So far, that has produced no good results, but that's what we're all doing.
Well, there seems to be a generational divide with younger people embracing the new technology. But you're one of the people who really has embraced it, though you're of a certain age.
I am. I'm old. But I love the internet. I look at the way I function now. I sit down to write something, and I need to know something like I don't know. I need to know the population of Rhode Island for some reason. And in the old days, I would have had to go find the almanac and look up the Now I get on the internet and I Google, population of Rhode Island. And the next thing I know, I have 111 million pages to look at.
But half of them have misinformation.
Right. And also, pretty soon I'm going here, I'm going there. And then the next thing I know, I'm reading an article about fruit flies of the Ryukyu Islands, I'm wasting time faster than ever before, thanks to the internet. That's really what I'm saying. It's a great way to not do what you're supposed to be doing. I need a search engine that whatever you type in, it comes back with, get back to work.
Well, I recently interviewed an author and asked him certain questions about his life, and he said, oh, it's all wrong, but you must have been reading my Wikipedia file.
I did one time look up myself on Wikipedia, and I was horrified. But, you know, apparently, you know, people decide what is important about your life. And some of it was true, but just seemed so spectacularly irrelevant to me, you know, and so I decided I was never going to go back and look at it again.
My Wikipedia file has me married to somebody who is no longer alive, actually.
But we were never married. The inflatable dolls on there anywhere?
It's shocking how much misinformation there is. You also write about the healthcare crisis, and your conclusion there is pretty bleak. Do you think that it's basically impossible to come up with a workable healthcare system in this country?
Yes. But I mean, I'm not an expert, but I'd say yes.
Well, there are other countries where they've worked it out.
Well, really? Which ones?
Oh, if you've ever been sick in France, you know that...
I have been sick in France, but the next day I felt better. And then I learned that's why you don't mix all those different kinds of alcohol.
But you go to a doctor. It's just fabulous. Germany is very inexpensive. England works.
Then maybe...
Canada, the Canadians, I know that whenever people talk about a national health plan here, people say, well, in Canada, you got to wait. Well, the Canadians love their system, as far as I can tell, and you got to wait here as well.
Okay, I think we should just start sending people to all those.
Let's send them to Canada, right?
You know what I think, though? I mean, I have to say.
You don't like the health care bill that just passed?
I don't really know anything about the health care bill that just passed. I don't know that anybody knows anything about it. I do know this. It did not address the one issue that I think was the most important, which is, and I think you're going to agree with me on this. We need to find a way for the medical profession to get to the prostate gland other than the way they're getting to it now. We need a procedure where the doctor stands like 80 yards away.
Looks good from here, Dave.
Well, you do have an essay here, the only one that was published before, about getting a colonoscopy. And that one is much more serious than the others.
Well, yeah. I mean, it was one of the rare instances where I actually had a point to make.
You actually had a point to make?
It's very unusual for me. And some facts. I did not get a colonoscopy when I was supposed to. I was supposed to when you're around being turned 50, and I didn't. I even wrote a column about getting colonoscopy, but I never actually got a colonoscopy. I got past 60, and then I got a call from my brother Sam, who's 10 years younger than I am, who went and got a colonoscopy when he turned 50, which is what you're supposed to do. He's more adult than I am. And they found a problem. They found cancer. And fortunately, they found it early, and they operated on him, and he's fine now. Everything was fine. But I remember he called me and said, you know, I just want you to know that they screened me, and I have cancer. And I know, I'm sure you already got screened, but they said it's important that your brothers get screened too. And of course, I hadn't done it, so I went and got one, and I wrote an essay about why you should get one, and I do want to stress that it's really not bad. I mean, it's nothing to it.
Well, you're warned that it's terribly painful, but
it's not.
They knock you out, don't they?
It's not terribly.
That's what happened to me.
There's no pain at all. But even they do knock you out, except in Canada they don't knock you out. But they do.
Well,
knock.
if you're from the United States, they don't knock you out.
Exactly. For now they knock you out. But the one thing I have to warn people is they give you the procedure itself is nothing. They do give you the day before, a nuclear laxative. So powerful that your bowels travel into the future and you expel food you have not even eaten yet. So you have to be prepared for that part of it. The rest of the actual procedure, nothing.
My guest is Dave Barry, whose latest book is I'll Mature When I'm Dead, Dave Barry's Amazing Tales of Adulthood. It is published by Putnam. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You have another medical essay here. It's about getting a vasectomy.
Yes.
And in it, you compare the male reproductive system to the New York City transit system.
Yes, I do. I can't
so,
remember,
so
can't
the
remember
F
the
train is canceled on weekends
but
in your body?
I believe Staten Island is like the what was Staten Island? I can't remember which gland it was. But Brooklyn and Queens play the part of the testes. Mm-hmm. Queens. And then I know that the Brooklyn Bridge is an important vessel in this system. And I believe I have the female vagina being played by Van Cortlandt Park in the Bronx. But it all makes sense geographically. It's a much easier way to remember how the reproductive system works.
You also compare men and women to elephants and dandelions to explain why single women over a certain age have so much trouble finding a man.
Right. I based that on – I started this spinning class with my wife. and where you go and you sit in a room that smells like an armpit, basically, and you ride a bicycle to nowhere while they play loud music. Everybody in a class but me is a woman. The instructor's a woman. All the other the spinners are all women. I'm the only man there.
What is achieved by the spinning?
I don't know.
Well, you must have gone for some reason, other than to accompany your wife.
You know, you do it to get in shape, to be fit, and
it's a cardio thing.
Yeah, I think. But, you know, after a while, women sort of forget that I'm there and I can hear what women talk about. And all they talk about is men, and not in a positive way either.
Did it make you feel bad? Did you see yourself in some of the things they said?
No, I had to agree with them. They were right about everything. I just felt they didn't actually understand why men act the way they do. And the main issue there was, and it's my wife's complaint all the time, she knows all these smart, attractive, funny, nice women who can't find a guy. Cannot find a guy. All the guys are, you know. And why is that? And so I wrote an essay called The Elephant and the Dandelion, trying to explain how male and female biology works, which explains why men are the way they are.
Which ones are the males, the elephants or the
dandelions? We are the dandelion. The elephant is I compare women to elephants because they have a long gestation period. And then, you know, to keep their DNA going, they have to, first of all, carry the child for the last time, give birth to the child, and then nurture the child until the child is old enough to act on its own, which in modern America is about 40 years old. The man, keep his DNA going, his best shot is just spread it everywhere, spew his seed everywhere, just like a dandelion. Have sex with pretty much anything that moves, any reasonably soft object. Now, I don't want to keep coming back to your inflatable dolls, but, you know, men are just, they're just that way. But my point is that's the biology of men. That's how we keep our DNA going. We can't help the fact that we're scum.
I did go out with a woman who kept on asking me, why do men do this? Why do men do that? And, you know, I didn't feel like it was my job to be the
explainer. Take on that.
You do explain why?
I have a whole chapter in the book devoting to answering the questions that women are always asking about. I did a little survey, you know, a bunch of women on the internet and friends of my wife and so on. And all these questions, of course, they're all critical. Women never ask questions like, how can men be so darn rational all the time? Or
so
how
nice.
What can men teach women about getting through life with fewer than 68 pairs of shoes? You know, never. They always ask, like, why? You know, it's always a why don't you? And like, why don't men put the toilet seat down? Why do they have to keep changing channels? Why are they so obsessed with breasts? That kind of thing. And I point out that there's really good, solid, important reasons why men do these things. It's because we care. It's because millions of years ago, when they were protecting the tribe, the village, from marauding tribes that would come in, men could not afford to waste time aiming where they were urinating or putting the toilet seat down. Men had to keep their heads on a swivel and be ready in case that attack came at that exact moment. That's why men are the way. We care. That's why. We have a lot of responsibility. That's why.
Do you convince women when you tell them?
No, none of this is effective at all.
Several of the essays deal with parenthood. Yeah. You mentioned your daughter. I have the feeling that you're very much involved in her upbringing.
A little too involved lately. I have to take her to her annual dance recital. My wife is a sports writer, and she's going to be gone to South Africa covering the World Cup, which means I'm alone taking my daughter to the dance recital.
That bothers you?
Oh, my God. Have you ever gone to a dance recital?
I would have a hard time going to the World Cup. I mean, I used to like soccer, but I do find it kind of boring.
At least you can drink beer at the World Cup. At the dance recital, there's no beer. You can't listen to the radio. You just have to watch. You know, and I don't mind. I'm happy to watch my daughter dance. I just don't want to watch the daughter of everybody else in North America dance, which is what you have to do at the dance recital.
But you say that parents these days are taking all the fun out of kids' sports as well. It's not just dance recital.
Yeah, I have an essay in there about my daughter's in a soccer team also. And we went to this tournament in Disney World, 300 teams, soccer teams. And I've never seen anything like this. I didn't realize how it's like these parents on the sidelines screaming. And they're often wearing matching shirts, matching their team shirts, screaming angrily at their children. For like through the entire match, and you couldn't tell whether they were winning or losing. It didn't seem to matter. They were just angry all the time. Now, I don't get what that's about.
Yeah, what's happened? There was a time when parents just said to the kid, go out and play, have fun.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you win or lose.
And they say that still, but they don't mean it. When I was a kid, you know, this is going to sound like when I was a young man. When I was growing up in Armonk, New York, I was in the Armonk Little League for years, and no parents came. You know, if the coaches came, but that was it. If a parent had come and sat in the bleachers at the Armonk Little League and screamed for a whole game at their children, the way they do now, we would have thought that person was a lunatic. I don't know when it shifted to suddenly it became a way to support your child or so. But it puts this huge amount of pressure on the kids. And the kids, of course, buy into it. If they think the parents think the game is that important, it must be that important. And I just sort of wish people would say, no, it's a game. It's not that important. You're not going to be a professional athlete. Have fun. And they say that. You know, I hear the coaches say, we want you to have fun out there. But then the behavior of the coaches and the parents suggests it's not fun at all. It's very serious.
Because they're the ones who are so competitive.
It's all about the parents. The kids will adapt whatever values the parents, you know, imbue in them. But that's what it comes down to is that we're raising kind of jerky kids, I think, by making them make it so important whether they win or lose a 9-year-old soccer game, you know.
You live in Miami.
I do.
So there can be a lot more soccer games than there are here.
We have a lot of soccer games, a lot of baseball games, but we have a fairly my daughter's team is a fairly laid back group of parents, except for my wife, who's Cuban Jewish and can't be laid back.
Well, do you think parents these days get too involved in their kids' lives?
Yes,
I do. And is that a change? Were your parents involved in your life?
No, my dad was busy commuting to and from his job in New York City, and my mom was busy trying to deal with four of us, so there wasn't really that much time to worry about any particular one of us. And I think that was healthier. I just think, you know, there are too many parents who think they can sort of funnel their child through life all the way to Harvard and beyond by doing this now, by doing this now. You know, this is not a new observation on my part, but despite the fact that every parent seems to be aware of what a joke it is, that parents are so determined to control their children's existence, it just gets worse, it seems, every year.
Can we talk a bit about Miami?
No.
I haven't been there. I know. I hate when people preface. Can I ask you? I've only been to Miami a couple of times.
Come on, Dan.
And when people talk about New York as being a foreign country, at least where I've the way I've experienced Miami, usually in South Beach because I've gone for some event, it strikes me as a foreign, not in a foreign country, like an extraterrestrial experience.
Yeah, that's what I would say. I moved there in 1986 from the United States. It really is unlike any city I know of in the United States. It is such an exotic place. And things happen there. I have a whole chapter here devoted to visiting Miami, what you can do and what you can't do. And we have had a bad reputation. We had a situation where a courtesy bus at the airport containing Norwegian tourists was hijacked.
I remember.
Which, you know, that will never – Norway, like, doesn't have crime like that. Norway doesn't have crime. If there was this show called CSI Norway, most of the crimes would involve, like, improperly labeled salmon or something. But in Miami, they were hijacked, and that created.
But it didn't hurt the tourism.
Well, no, and that's what's so funny about Miami is when I first moved there, it was the cocaine cowboy era, and everything was going crazy, and they were trying so hard in Miami to say, no, we're not so bad, we're not. In fact, that was my proposed tourism solution: come back to Miami, we're not shooting at you. but what really made Miami popular, and I was there when it happened, was Miami Vice. Mm-hmm. And what did it show? It showed this insanely dangerous city where people are, you know, killing each other all the time, but they looked cool, they drove cool cars, there was cool music playing in the background. That's what Miami has to sell. It is a safer place than it used to be now, but that's still why people come to Miami. They don't come to Miami because they want Disney World. They come to Miami because they wanted a little bit of romance, excitement, a little feeling of danger.
Well, what I always think of is the footwear, women wearing sandals that I would not expect to see anywhere else in the world.
It isn't just the footwear that women wear. Women dress in Miami, like, I don't know how they do it. I don't know how you could show much of that of your body and still be wearing something, as they do routinely in Miami.
So with that in mind, how do you get into the mindset that allows you to write children's books? You write them with Ridley Pearson. How did that come about?
Well, it came out – Ridley and I are in a band, a rock band of authors called the Rock Bottom Remainders. In fact, mm-hmm. We just performed in New York City.
Scott Turow is going to be here tomorrow. Okay. One of your band members, along with Amy Tan, Stephen King.
Yep. When Scott is on, I do hope you ask him to sing one of his songs for you.
He writes good songs?
No, he's really bad. That's why I ask you to sing.
Oh, I see.
But no, Scott's a wonderful example of what our band is. We're enthusiastic as opposed to talented. But anyway, Ridley is the bass player. And some years ago, the band was playing in Miami. And he was staying at my house. And he breakfast, he said, he was reading Peter Pan to his daughter, Paige. And she stopped him and asked him, how did Peter Pan meet Captain Hook in the first place? And how come he can fly? Where did he come from? Where does Peter Pan come from? And Ridley thought, said that would be kind of an interesting question to try to answer in a book. And he said, I was going to write a prequel to Peter Pan. And I said, that's a great idea. You should do that. He said, you want to do it with me? And so we did. We wrote a book called Peter and the Star Catchers, which Disney published, which did very well. And we've now written, we're on our fifth one of those. So it's just fun. It's a little different.
Did it bother you when people kept on mistaking you for Carl Hiaasen and telling you how much they loved Hoot?
This happens to me all the time. I'll be sitting in an airport, usually in Florida, and somebody will come up and go, I don't want to bother you. And I'm all modest. I go, oh, no, it's no bother, really. You know, I'm ready to get the compliment. And they go, Stay, I love your work. And I go, oh, thanks. They go, loved Hoot. I have to go, that's Carl Hiaasen. And he's a good, you know, oh, I'm so sorry. And I go, no, it's okay. Carl's a friend of mine. And then they always say, I love your work, too. But they're lying at that point.
Well, they have
that's the kind of celebrity I am. In fact, I have a chapter in a book about, like, there's a celebrity glut, you know, and it's harder and harder for minor celebrities like me to. I mean, like, how many Kardashian sisters are there? It's like maybe 40 or 50 of them. And what did they do? We need to clamp down on enough with health care. We need to do something about that celebrity problem in this country.
You also include a couple of spoofs of pop culture phenomena, the Twilight vampire books and the TV series 24.
Yeah, this book
Do you wonder how these things get to be so popular?
I've long been a big fan of 24.
Yeah.
I blog it. So I had to include a script of 24, kind of the ultimate 24 script, where, for example, Jack Bauer gets into a gunfight on an elevator with 18 hostiles and kills them all, you know, as the elevator goes from the third to the fourth floor. Because that's the kind of thing that happens. But I also had to write a vampire novel called Fangs of Endearment. The book actually contains a complete vampire novel. Short, but complete.
The title, I'll Mature When I'm Dead, of course, is reminiscent of Warren Zevon's biography, I'll Sleep When I'm Dead.
Warren played with our band for many years.
So this is a kind of conscious homage?
I don't know if it's conscious.
Homage, whatever.
Homage. Yeah, I mean, I was definitely thinking of Warren when I suggested that.
How did that band get together? A bunch of people who are rock wannabes?
The premise was this woman named Kathy Goldmark, who was a media escort in San Francisco. She's the one to pick you up and take you around to your pick you at the airport and take you around to your interviews. And she's also in the music scene out there, and so she got to know who was into music and who wasn't. And she had this idea one year at the Booksellers Convention to get together a group of authors with musical talent to hold a concert to raise money for a First Amendment cause. And the flaw in that plan was that none of the authors had any musical talent, but we stayed together as a band because we had so much fun.
And are you getting better because you've been playing together for so many years?
Here's the problem. Our genre, Roy Blunt Jr., who's one of our members, calls it hard listening music. The problem is, and we understand that other bands, when they start a song, have already rehearsed it and know before they even start what chords are going to be in it and where it's going to end and that sort of thing. And we really kind of work those things out as we're playing the song by looking at each other with panic on our faces. That's our approach to the
We all live in very different places, so it must be hard to get together to rehearse.
We don't rehearse. I mean, that's another thing. I understand some of your top bands do rehearse, and I think it's kind of unfair to compare us with bands that rehearse.
So are you working, now that you're not doing the column, and this book seems to me to be as you said, a compilation of columns that would have been published if you were still doing that at the Herald. Are you thinking long form these days, or are you just going to continue doing pieces that are kind of like newspaper columns?
Well,
only with more dirty words.
Not many. Probably both. I'll still write humor. I'll always write humor. I think of myself as that first and foremost. But I'm doing another book with Ridley, and I think I'll write another adult novel. Oh, well, we use the term adult loosely, but another non-children novel one of these days.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us. We've been talking with Dave Barry, who for a while felt like he was a regular on the show because you just kept on publishing
books
and
here.
We kept on inviting you, and we haven't seen you for a while.
I couldn't find you. You moved and didn't tell me where you'd moved to. This is really nice. This
is so much better than the old studio.
Yes. Yeah, there's like no bats or anything.
And the floors are clean.
Sort of. Yeah.
And the ceiling isn't leaking, and we don't have fungus in the underneath the ceiling tiles as we did in the other building.
Yeah, I remember all those things, not fondly.
Dave Barry's latest book is called I'll Mature When I'm Dead, Dave Barry's Amazing Tales of Adulthood. It is published by Putnam. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Leonard, thank you for having me.